Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 14, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss access to financial services. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome Shamina Singh to our call today. She's the president of the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. She also serves as the chair of the Corporation for National and Community Services Board of Directors, a board which I serve on as well. So she's, in that respect, a colleague of mine. So I'm particularly gratified to have her participate in our call today. She's going to begin with opening remarks. Then we'll probably have a little discussion from one of her colleagues. And then I might ask a question or two. But as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions. So please do have your questions in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Shamina Singh, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dean, and thank you for everyone who has joined this call today. I'm really excited to be part of the conversation about financial inclusion, access to financial services, and the cost of cash. It's an interesting topic, one that I have been researching for quite some time, and one that I'm also interested in understanding what the Federalist Organization's members think about the topic. For MasterCard, a company that is a technology company in the payment space, a lot of times folks think about MasterCard as a credit card company or a bank. And the truth is it's neither. It's the technology rails that connect buyers and sellers in a way that allows them to engage electronically and are assured that their transactions are safe and secure, and that as a cardholder, as a electronic transaction user, you get what you say you're going to get, and the buyer is validated by their bank, the seller is validated by their bank, and people sort of get to the place where they need to go with regard to the transaction. There are a lot of rules and that are involved in that, in just that very, very short process. But it's a process that allows the technology to do very interesting things. And that's what got me involved at MasterCard, because one of the things that we discovered early on was that as you engage electronically, there are also not only there are costs to and benefits to engaging electronically, but there are costs and benefits, obviously, to engaging in cash. Some early research that we conducted around the costs of cash led us to understand that, in actuality, 85% of transactions around the world are still conducted in cash. That's 85%. So only 15% of transactions are conducted electronically, and that is by MasterCard, by Visa, by Amex, by Discover, by any of these electronic payment facilities. So when we think about the potential competition or the potential opportunity for business growth, we really think about the growth in cash economies, or people who are still conducting most of their transactions in cash. So for us, the competition doesn't necessarily mean MasterCard versus Visa or another company. It really is the competition against cash. And why is that interesting? And why is that? Why are we particularly interested in engaging the Federalist Society in this conversation? Is because I think you all bring a very interesting perspective around the balance between connection to financial services, connection to technology, the role of technology, the role of financial services, and human economic potential. And that's the thing I really want to talk about today, is economic potential. It's what the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth is focused on, through connection to the modern networks that drive the economy. So, for example, our theory of change involves human beings and their connection to these sorts of networks. The networks can be education networks, for example, resource networks, healthcare networks, but that there are these networks that are driving engagement, driving business, driving activity across not only the United States, but indeed the world. And if you're not connected up into these networks, then you really are stuck in your sort of particular geography, your place in life, where you were born, your family, whatever that is. But this notion of social mobility or unlocking your economic potential really does depend on how connected you are up into these networks. The financial service network is one that we're really focused on, and in particular, financial inclusion. And our notion around financial inclusion is one that that really focuses on the fact that if 85% of transactions are still done in cash, that constitutes about between 2 billion people in the world today who are completely disconnected from a financial service engagement, but certainly more than 2 billion who operate within this formal the formal economy and the shadow economy. And for those who are either uniformly operating in a shadow economy or even spending most of their time in the shadow economy, you can imagine what that means in terms of taxes, in terms of nefarious illegal behavior, and in terms of personal safety and security. So we find that these types of transactions mostly happen, obviously, in drug cartels, in leakage, in corruption with government, potentially, or corruption with aid systems. And what we're really trying to do with this this connection to the formal economy, to bring more people into the formal economy, is really an attempt to help not only individuals realize their own economic potential, but also to make sure that we're bringing efficiencies to government programs and government services, that we're bringing efficiencies to things like international aid programs, where when oftentimes these programs or these government services are conducted in cash or paper vouchers, it does open the door to leakage, or what many people call in a cash economy, when there are many middle people involved between the actual service getting to a person or the cash benefit getting to a person. And when you have a lot of people in the mix there, it often leads to crime and sometimes a lot of corruption. And so we do think that there is an opportunity in this space to not only help and work with individuals to reach their economic potential through financial inclusion and economic opportunity in these networks, but also by reducing the reliance on cash transactions in international aid delivery, in government programs and services, and the like, that we can bring more efficiencies to government programs and tax recovery. And finally, this notion of the United States and what we think we might be able to engage in a conversation with you all about is what that might look like as we think about our entry into the United States. For the most part, the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth has been operating in emerging markets, in economies where there isn't as much opportunity to engage in, because it is such cash-heavy economies, the opportunity for digitization and the like is much more prevalent. And so as we think about our engagement in the United States, what are the types of things we might think about? Who are the types of organizations we might partner with? Who's doing interesting work in this regard? And before I turn it back over to Dean to engage in a couple of Q&A, I thought I might introduce the newest member of the MasterCard Center's team, Manu Bardwaj, who is an attorney and recently joined the center to really help us think through the macroeconomic and research opportunities in the space, and to also offer his perspective, both from a legal background, but also from a government and private sector background, about his perspectives on the issue, and certainly as a fresh pair of eyes to the center. So, Manu, over to you.
Thanks, Shamina. It's been really fantastic to work with you and the team at MasterCard. And I think the perspective I also bring is as a State Department diplomat for the past 6 years on sustainable economic development issues. My first interaction with the center was when we were bringing together local businesses, think tanks, policymakers, and thought leaders in major U.S. cities over 6 weeks in an effort to capture, compile, and share best practices on how to foster an environment that helped jobs and income rise and expand the middle class. These are issues that are global. They're issues that are being faced in Europe, in India, where we're seeing a number of folks think about ways to help the working poor, particularly in the U.S., in cities. And it's great to see the center and the strong team at MasterCard thinking about how to help business leaders identify critical challenges that are facing American communities and try to find really tangible solution-based approaches to addressing some of the challenges that are really headline news today in the United States and all over the world. So, you know, I think in terms of what are some of the critical challenges that I've seen through the work at the center, it's, you know, rising income inequality, you know, lack of access to financial tools that you touched on, Shamina, where 29% of U.S. households are unbanked or underbanked, and the highest unbanked are low-income or unemployed or younger households. The barriers to entrepreneurship, where access to financial capital is often a major challenge for small firms, especially women-owned businesses and other businesses. Cities that are struggling to use data to improve services, where nearly half of cities surveyed in many philanthropies point out to a shortage of staff and financial resources dedicated to gathering and evaluating data that can help their decision making. So I just provide those as a few examples of some of the recent thinking of the center in thinking about inclusion, digital economy, the role of data philanthropy, and the potential for work with organizations and members at the Federalist Society and elsewhere on these really important apolitical, bipartisan topics. Thanks, Shamina.
Thank you, Manu. Dean, over to you.
Well, thank you both. I'm going to open the floor to questions now, although I have a couple questions of my own I want to get to, but maybe people can begin queuing up. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our guests, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our first caller, I'm going to pick up on a couple things each of you said. Shamina Singh, you mentioned leakage, especially in U.S. aid. I want to know if you want to say more about that. I take that to mean, you know, there is U.S. aid money directed at a certain place, and some of it's diverted. That's what leakage is, and it's done illicitly. And I guess the thinking is that because it's done in cash, it's more vulnerable to leakage. And if it were done in a digital way, it would be less vulnerable to leakage. Have I got that right?
Well, I think the opportunity there is to, with electronic payment and with technology, is to remove the opportunity for illegal behavior. And so to the extent that, to your point, there are instances where cash is distributed with cash trucks and the like in emergency situations and through international aid delivery, the opportunity to digitize and streamline those transactions that really would empower, frankly, the recipients to act on their own behalf and with their own agency and, frankly, with the dignity around electronic payment that allows them to feed the local economy, I think there's an enormous opportunity to streamline and electronify that supply chain, if you will.
Right. So, and it feels to me it's just like lost money, that money we intend to go somewhere that's not getting there. So there's an international component to this. And Manu, you mentioned sort of the domestic component of that, the number of people, the percentage of people in this country, in the United States, who are unbanked or underbanked. And you mentioned some of the consequences. I don't know if either of you can talk a little bit more about some of the consequences here in the United States of being unbanked. What does that mean in terms of opportunities to become an entrepreneur or just day-to-day life?
And I'm happy to jump in here, Manu, on this one. Listen, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a small business, one of the things that we've heard more than anything else is that access to credit or access to funding to finance equipment growth or technology or build businesses. It's a huge barrier to the engine of small business that drives our economy. And to the extent that we're thinking about ways to reduce risk around lending to small businesses. And so this is a very simple example, but one I think might resonate with some of the members. And that is, if you're a small business or even an individual proprietor and you're looking to start a business, the barriers to the marketplace can be very high. And so oftentimes small businesses, they'll use their own credit cards to pay for the pay for business startup expenses, pay for tax help, pay for whatever it takes to start the business. People use their personal credit cards. We see a lot of that. And the question is it because we're not looking at credit as an explanation for financial behavior, but we're looking at credit on terms that may be different for this particular population? And what do I mean by that? Well, right now, your access to credit is based on your liquidity, collateral, very traditional notions of how you access credit, when in actuality, there might be other indicators of your creditworthy behavior. So do you pay your bills on time? Do you pay your rent on time? Do you, if you are the recipient of a social benefit of some sort, are you, how are you spending that money? How are you engaging? Some people even think about their social media activity as a potential space for creditworthiness, meaning, how many friends do you have on Facebook, or how many transactions have you received for your small business on Facebook or on Etsy? And so it's just trying to look at the entire system in its, comprehensively, to look across the board and say, where are areas that we might help have another look at these more conventional constructs to see if there are ways that we might unleash productivity. So those are just some examples. But Manu, do you want to add any there?
No, I think what was most surprising for me as someone who's new to the center is just this notion of the cost of cash. That is to say that, yes, of course, like you said, Shamina, 80% of the transactions today are in cash, and yet what that means often is that there's a lot of associated costs with just being able to obtain that cash, in terms of, you know, having to go to the bank, having to wait in line to get your paycheck, all of these costs that are really not really given a lot of visibility in mainstream thinking, but often do affect a number of folks that are kind of at the bottom of the income layer. So I would just add that this concept of cost of cash, I think, is one that was entirely new to me at the center, and I think it's one that we should all be thinking about in terms of how do we can spread more financial inclusion to the rest of American society in particular.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you're in the audience. We have one caller with a question pending. Before we go there, let's broaden this out just a little bit before we take a call. I know the center's focus includes financial inclusion, but there's also a broader role here. I wonder if you could tell us about other projects outside the financial inclusion space that the center engages around inclusive growth.
So, Dean, we're really excited, and Manu made a little bit of mention of this. Another area that we're looking at very closely is this idea of data and data, what we call data philanthropy, for lack of a better word. But the idea is that, in this economy, the abundance of data and the amount of data that's being produced every second of every day is just enormous. And what we're seeing, rightly so, is that a lot of this data is commercialized data. So it's data that's being that helps governments or helps businesses, retailers, and the like, maybe target their consumers better or market to their consumers better, or for consumers to use data to maybe make better choices about products and services. All very interesting and very valuable uses of data. One of the areas that we haven't seen a lot of activity and where we'd like to see more is the building out of capacity in sort of social sector organizations around access to data and data usage more appropriately. So even an organization like the Federalist Society or maybe another nonprofit who may have access, you know, may have information, may have questions, may have thoughts on how to advance an agenda or how to make a city service more efficient or, you know, have connect more people to the economy, which is what we're trying to do. They may have thoughts around this, but because we haven't made the investment in the social nonprofit sector to build out the data analytics capacity, we're seeing an increasing gap form between the commercialization and those who have the opportunity to commercialize data and those who don't have the opportunity. So we're really thinking through opportunities to extend data for good, if you will, create capacity within the social sector to bring data into the conversation. And we have a few examples around that that I'd be happy to go into if there's interest. But most recently, we made our first data grant to Harvard University for a special study that a professor there is doing on building out economic models in several countries around the world. And so the data that we were able to provide him really accelerated his ability to make his analysis in a way that provided hands-on help to you know, organizations and governments around the world. So that's just one example, but a lot more that we're wrestling with and really excited about.
Interesting. Well, we do have a couple questions now pending, so let me take a first call here.
Thanks for the information. This has been very interesting. My question is U.S. focused, but I believe it has broad principles. Manu mentioned the highest unbanked are poor and young families or underbanked. And I'm curious, what are the challenges in the U.S. market for getting more consumers transacting in cash to use e-banking or to have access to it? And to what extent, how many U.S. citizens only buy, for example, small dollar consumer items in cash? And what are the barriers to help the working poor get access to e-banking?
It's a great question, and I think one that that we're working on, and would love more research done in this space. We find the barriers. It's interesting, right? So, if you're working, if you have a job, many employers in the United States actually use maybe prepaid cards to pay their employees. Maybe because what they're finding is that sometimes employees don't have bank accounts, and those barriers might be, you know, perceived or real, but the idea of costs of banking maybe, or access to brick and mortar, you know, banks and things like that. And so I know that there's a lot of conversation among the financial service institutions to do things more digitally and to try to reach a broader audience. But I think in that gap, what we're seeing is time. I mean, it's the stuff that you and I think about. You know, time is our commodity. Time is the asset. Bandwidth, cost, quality of service, and things like that. And so if you are operating in an economy where you do engage more in low dollar or high volume transactions, then the barriers are real, and the time to make those transactions is much longer. So it's just it's a higher hill to climb if you're somebody who is operating in a cash economy.
Shamina, this is Dean Reuter. I wonder. I'm just back from a vacation in Mexico. I did run into a lot of vendors down there, and this isn't an area frequented by international tourists. A lot of vendors there either were not capable of taking credit cards or unwilling to take credit cards. So this is just by way of supporting the statement about a lot of in a lot of developing countries, there seems to be a bias in favor of cash.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, in this country, again, this is personal experience, is any of the lack of participation in the banking industry by customers based in sort of a skepticism about the overall system? That was a concern of my grandparents' generation,
mm-hmm.
Having lived through the Depression, having lost some money, even in the savings mm-hmm. and loan issues, I guess, in the 70s, or do we know why? I mean, is it an inability to participate in this country in the banking system? Is it a perception of the cost? Is it a skepticism about banking soundness? Are there some major government impediments that prevent people from participating in banking?
Mm-hmm. I think it's all of that and probably more, Dean. So, I mean, one of the things that we talk a lot about at MasterCard is trust. And if the trust between buyer and seller is of enormous importance. And this usually banks are the sort of the brokers of that trust. And so, to the extent that institutions have are lacking in access to consumers in a way that allows them to have more interaction with them, then the trust does become an issue. And so everything we do, I know, at MasterCard and certainly in the electronic payment space is built on this notion of you have to get what you pay for. You have to be able to, when you swipe your card or tap your phone or do whatever you need to do, that the transaction has to happen. Nobody wakes up in the morning saying, gee, I wonder how I'm going to pay today. They wake up and they say, how am I going to buy food, or how am I going to go to the movies, or how am I going to do something else? And so the act of purchasing that experience or the commodity should not be the thing that anybody thinks about. To your point about Mexico and merchant engagement in a lot of the emerging markets, most of those transactions are done in cash, and for a number of reasons. One of which is access to the services, right? So access to the equipment, or access to the electricity, or access to a consistent source of electricity, or access to the type of equipment that you might need to accept credit cards, if you will, or accept payment in that way. And one of the really interesting things that we have actually been very involved in is innovating in that space, because if our goal is to reduce the friction between buyer and seller, then we also have to reduce the amount that it takes to allow electronic payment. So one of the things that we're really excited about is something called MasterPass QR. And basically what that is in certain markets around the world, mostly in India and in Africa, we've introduced the idea of being able to use QR codes instead of QR codes with phones instead of having to necessarily use a card. So if you are in India right now and you want to, get a rickshaw driver, we have enabled a technology that allows you to use your phone to scan the rickshaw driver's QR code and pay the rickshaw driver using that kind of digital payment with your phone. That type of technology completely removes the point of sale device, that barrier that exists between the rickshaw driver and you, that he has to swipe or tap or do whatever he has to do, and makes it really about between the customer and the QR code. And the really interesting thing is it's a payment system that allows each bank to verify that you are you and they are they, and the transaction has the same level of safety and security as a transaction here in the United States might have. And so I think when you and I think about the innovations that are required to bring more people into the system, or e-banking to the first caller's point, I think it's about also an openness to new technology and innovation and maybe doing things differently. And I think that's a little bit about what we're finding in more developed markets, is that there are legacy systems and legacy, regulatory environments that make it a little bit tougher to maybe test and learn from new technologies or new experiences. And what we're finding in more developing markets is there is, the regulatory environment has not, gotten to the point where you can't try new things in the space. And so these are just the types of learnings we're finding, but I hope that gets a little bit to your question about Mexico and why or why not merchants are engaging in the electronic payment system.
It does. That's interesting stuff. The technology you mentioned, the QR code, reminds me of, I think it's the same technology we can use here to get on to board an airplane, where you can have
a boarding
pass within your telephone.
Yeah.
it's interesting, and it raises a question in my mind. We still have two audience questions, but I can't resist asking you this, whether or not, with regard to some of these technological advances, do you see a reluctance in older people? And I would count myself in that cohort. I'm 56 years old, but I find when I travel, I still print a boarding pass because I'm a little skeptical. I just like the comfort of having a printed boarding pass in case my phone doesn't work at the critical moment that I'm trying to get on a plane. Is that, do you see a problem there? My kids, of course, use the telephone exclusively. They don't print a boarding pass. But is there a generational difference there with regard to the acceptance of the technology?
Yeah, I would say, look, I don't want to make generalizations about
I don't know if
age.
Study
I mean, as somebody who is, you know, has, you know, very quickly approaching my AARP card, but I think that it's all, you know, it's user-based, right? And so I think the larger point is the easier that we can make it, the more usage there will be. And so our job as, you know, experts in this space and technology experts is to make sure that we're working from the customer back versus the product in. And so making sure that Dean can comfortably use whatever device he's comfortable using. So it could be a card, it could be your phone, it could be, some people are even using wearables now. So it could be your bracelet or a Fitbit that ends up processing payment because that's an easier device for you to use. But the idea is the choice should be yours and it should cater to your specific situation. An interesting thing, and this isn't necessarily focused on age, but one of the things that I found with my own mother is that, you know, when she has to mail a package or she has to, you know, send something, her first point of entry is the post office because that's just what she's always done is just she's just gone to the post office. So this notion of going to or mailing from home or doing something like that just isn't something that she's used to doing. And one of the things that we have a partnership with the post office actually in Italy, where the Italian government has given the post office in Italy license to engage in low-level banking so that so if somebody like my mother showed up at an Italian post office, she could do very basic banking there. She could buy a train ticket. She could she could transact on a number of different things because she's more comfortable doing it in a post office than maybe the high tech, tech zone down the street. And so but the idea is how do we make sure we're meeting people where they are and where they're most comfortable? And so I think this idea of using a post office or for Dean to, you know, print his pass for sure, but having that code on there, so instead of having somebody, you know, take one copy for the plane and one copy for the airport and one copy for the government, they have that cool QR code on the pass that all they do is they take it from your hand, Dean, put it on the computer, and then they've processed it so that everybody's aligned on the information. So it's about finding that balance between access and usage, and the less friction, the better, that I think is the challenge for all of us.
We've got a couple people patiently waiting with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, yes. My question is about blockchain technology and whether there is any application for making payments. I'm thinking particularly in an aid scenario where you want to make sure that the money is going to the right recipients, using that technology to make these kinds of transfers?
I think that's a great question and one that that we're all thinking about. With the advent of any new technology like blockchain or wearables or anything else, the question is, does it solve a problem in a way that needs solving? And so I think what we at MasterCard and many people around the world are trying to figure out is, you know, what is that application of blockchain that might solve an aid problem that's different from an electronic payment problem that we might be able to solve? So I think there's a lot of people trying really interesting things in the space. Like I've come across, blockchain banking in Africa and in other places where it's a distributed chain of people or, you know, computers or whomever who are participating in the validation of an identification or a property requirement or I haven't seen as much in the aid delivery space, but this idea of distributed technology is one that I think is really fascinating. I think for blockchain, though, there might be a ways to go in terms of bringing more people into the system who are able to participate in the blockchain validation scheme. And so that those are the types of conversations that I think many companies are having, but a lot of fintech companies are having, is around what blockchain, what are the capabilities of blockchain, and how might it be used to solve problems that we're having in the system.
Are you able to give us a quick definition of blockchain technology, just for some people who might not know exactly what it is?
Dean, I'm probably not the best person to give the definition of blockchain, but I think in its simplest form, the idea is that there are centralized forms of validation, and there are distributed forms of validation of things like ID or transaction or any kind of thing that might need some external validation of who you are, what the transaction is, and blockchain allows for a very distributed, an individual distribution of people who want to participate in validating the transaction. And there's a blockchain technology that lives in a different system, and there's a whole host of things like that. But I think the basic difference is centralized validation versus distributed technology validation.
That's helpful. Once again, we have one question pending now. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go right ahead with the next caller.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Hayden O'Byrne in Miami calling. Two questions. One, with respect to somewhere like Venezuela, where they have pretty stringent exchange controls, and as far as I know, nobody in their right mind would actually send money to Venezuela through official channels. How would something like this work if you want to take advantage of the realistic exchange rate as opposed to the government-mandated exchange rate? Because it would seem to me that the leakage would be, you know, an enormous percentage that the government takes off by exchanging the funds at the official exchange rate. And then secondly, a good part of the economy down here sort of runs on social networks, but they are somebody where your kids go to school, club memberships, those sorts of things. There's a lot of people in Miami that'll loan enormous amounts of money to people that they are connected with through those things on a handshake. And I think that's just the way that business is done in Miami. It's not based on credit scores, it's based on those personal relationships and your ability to make the person's life miserable if they don't pay you back. Is that something that you're looking at too? Because I mean, that's how this economy works. You know, and I, you know, I'll be out at drink somewhere, and you know, a friend of mine will tell me, "Don't talk to that person; he stiffed me." And you know, there are, you know, multi-million-dollar condo projects that go up in Miami on these types of deals. You know,
so
trade creditors.
Yeah, and trade credit as well. Yeah, I think that I'm probably not best positioned to answer the specifics of your question around Venezuela or and the exchange rates or even the handshake. But I think what you are raising is a really interesting question that we think about in terms of if you can't, so distribution, right? So if you can't see the person, how are you making sure that you can transact with that person? And I think that when I talked in the beginning, that's how sort of the electronic payment system was, that's why there's so many rules in some instances, is because for people who may not be able to, in a place to have the drinks or shake the hand or have the phone conversation, the personal networks, the idea is, can you create a global network of those types of transactions, maybe at a lower volume and a lower price point, but billions and billions and billions of these around the world. That's kind. You've just basically described, I think, the ascension of electronic payments and why it happened is because we don't all experience the benefit of maybe your network, your personal network, and how do you distribute that? Now, in terms of technology and in terms of how we're thinking about financial inclusion and those, I think what you're describing is informal networks. We are. I mean, I think that's to the point of how do you make sure that people who may not be, you know, as well networked as you might be in higher levels of income, how are we making sure that people are connecting up to these similar types of networks? And that's what we're finding is that there are a lot of people who are disconnected from these types of networks, so that their network of friends or their networks of family or business or whatever is at a much lower income scale, or it operates much more often in the informal economy. And what we're trying to figure out is, can we make bridges? Can we create bridges for those people and for those communities to ladder up to the networks that will allow them the social mobility to do the things that you've just described?
Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who else might ring in. Let me ask you a question about the future and the trajectory that the world is on. What are things going to look like? I mean, this might be an impossible question to answer, but what are things going to look like 20 years from now, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now? And are there things that people in our audience can do to move the world in one direction versus another?
I think it's a great question, and one that I think we're all, you know, we all ask ourselves every day. It's like, what are we doing right today that can have a positive impact 20 years from now? And you hear a lot about, or we hear a lot about, the Internet of Things, that, you know, all things will be they'll have some sort of digital capability, and that digitization will, this convergence between machine and man is, you know, coming soon. And so whether it's a refrigerator that can talk to your car, that can talk to your grandmother in Mississippi or whatever, but it's sort of like how everything is sort of moving towards AI and robots and driverless cars, like a lot of technology. And so I think that part of the reason why the center was created at MasterCard, and why we're, you know, reaching out to organizations like yours, Dean, is because we want to make sure that as the Internet of Everything increases, we're doing it in a way that also allows for the inclusion of everyone or anyone who wants to be a part. And so we worry about those who get left behind or those who are not being served by the technologies that are happening so quickly. And I think those are the types of questions that we wanted to at least raise with the folks at in your organization, is that, you know, we're thinking about this stuff, but my goodness, you guys are so smart and you're in the legal profession and you're, you know, looking at a whole host of issues. And if we could get this on your radar as something that we're wrestling with, maybe we could benefit from what a previous caller asked about, you know, sort of distributed thinking and this notion of networking the question out, crowdsourcing people in your organization to help us think about this stuff. But I do think the future is technology, and the future is, but what we want to make sure is that we're making sure that as this convergence of huge technology and data meets at the same time, the huge economic issues around individuals and joblessness and education and things like that, that we're trying to reduce the gap rather than widen it. Manu, do you want to add anything there?
I think building off your point, Shamina, I'm really interested in thinking about the parallel between digital inclusion and financial inclusion. So take the Mexico example that Dean had mentioned. So just recently, we've seen a huge uptick in their internet adoption rate, where almost 50 to 60% of Mexicans now are on cyberspace, are on the internet. And we know that based on some studies that 27% are using it, the internet, for entertainment, but only about 3 or 4% are using it for financial transactions or e-commerce or banking. And so there's a huge literacy component in terms of thinking about, you know, how will these trends play out not only in maybe urban cities in America or rural America, but then also globally, and what are kind of the ways to create the incentive structure to really spread financial inclusion and digital inclusion to the world.
It's the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. We've been talking about your efforts. Is there a way for our listeners to get more information? Is there a website you want to give out?
Sure, that'd be great. We'd love to have the listeners come to our website, which is www.mastercardcenter.org. We're also tweeting, so at CNTR for Growth is our Twitter handle. I'm at Shamina Singh. And if folks are interested, we always welcome blog posts things, blog posts or opinions or decisions, or if there are research issues, questions, opportunities that you all have that might be of interest and align, we'd love to talk to you about it, but would mostly love to hear your ideas and your thoughts and how we might work together to solve this enormous opportunity.
There are some fascinating issues here. Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, we still got a bit of time left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Seeing none, let me ask you if you've got any final thoughts, either of you. And if you don't mind, once again, if you could hit us with the website so people have pens in their hands at this point if they want to make a note of it.
Sure. It's MasterCardCenter.org is the website. And maybe as you post the podcast from this, we can share it. But I guess my final word is just to reemphasize that here at the center, we really are trying to use the convergence, this enormous ability of all the technologies that's out there with the enormous human economic potential, but also the enormous human need to bring those two things together to sort of say, look, we have enough to solve the problems that we're all thinking about. So now is the time. Now is the opportunity. So hopefully we can all work together to get it done. And really appreciate, Dean, again, you allowing us to take the time with you and your members.
Well, let me thank you both for participating. We certainly enjoyed having you on the call today. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your time and your questions. And a reminder to our audience to check the website, monitor your emails for the next Federalist Society Teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.